Hi there, my name is Nicole Stamp, and I'm sitting down today with professor and psychoanalyst Don Carveth to discuss the play Skylight by David Hare, which is playing June 10th to July 9th at CanStage's Berkeley Theatre in Toronto. Now, Skylight tells the story of two people, ex-lovers, who, after their affair ends, proceed in life in a way that indicates that they both are experiencing and carrying a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. So I'm sitting down with Don because he is actually an expert in human behavior, particularly in the realm of guilt and shame. Don, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here with you.
Can you, just to start us off, tell us who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm an emeritus professor of sociology and social and political thought at York University, Glendon campus, where I taught through most of my career. I continue to teach a course a year at York, Glendon. But in the 70s, I trained as a psychoanalyst in the Toronto Institute of Psychoanalysis. Went on to be its director, ended my term as director last July, but I continue as a training and supervising analyst. And I practice psychoanalysis with patients and also do a lot of, about half of my time is supervising people who are becoming psychotherapists and psychoanalysts.
Can you talk about how guilt and shame figure into the work that you do?
Majorly. I guess the reason I wrote a book about this a couple of years ago is simply because the themes of guilt and shame over the years just became so central in the work that I do with patients. When I'm talking about guilt, a lot of the time I'm not talking about conscious guilt. I'm talking about what Freud identified as unconscious guilt, or what he identified as guilt equivalents. A lot of people aren't aware that the anxiety attacks, the panic attacks, the depression, the psychosomatic disturbances, they're not aware that these symptoms that maybe bring them to a therapist have anything whatever to do with guilt. But we try to get at the unconscious. And very often, these symptoms are a matter of guilt and punishment. I mean, people are directing aggression at themselves, they're beating themselves up. Well, why are you beating yourself up? Very often because you feel very guilty about something that you may not consciously even know you're guilty about, but you're punishing yourself anyhow. And so the process works by helping people become aware, A, that their depression or anxiety in fact is an attack on themselves, and B, to try to figure out why they're attacking themselves and what it is. And I'm not saying that it's always, I mean, often the guilt is irrational guilt. A lot of the time it's rational guilt. A lot of the time people who are beating themselves up have good reasons to be beating themselves up. Sometimes they're beating themselves up for crimes they never committed. And so a big part of the therapy is to sort all of this out.
Do you identify a difference between guilt and shame?
Yes, I do. Shame is a narcissistic emotion. It's all about me. And on that level, that kind of shame is indistinguishable from a type. There are two main types of guilt: primitive, punitive, or persecutory guilt, in which I'm whipping myself. And that's almost indistinguishable from shame. Shame is just another manifestation of self-persecution. It's a horrible feeling. But there's another kind of guilt altogether, which is reparative guilt. In reparative guilt, you're not beating yourself up. Your mind is not on yourself. Your mind is on the person you've injured. So the example I always use is, I've injured someone and he's bleeding in the corner. Persecutory guilt or shame, I got the cat of nine tails and I'm flagellating. I'm such a terrible person. This is useless to the guy who's bleeding. If I put down the cat of nine tails, go get the repair kit, the safety kit, and I start bandaging, that's reparative guilt. So that in shame and in primitive or persecutory guilt, my mind is entirely on myself. We often think of selfishness or narcissism as how great I am, but it's equally narcissistic to be going on all the time about how terrible you are. I mean, that's why depressed people are a drag to be around, because all they can think of is themselves and how bad they are. You know, the move into reparative guilt is a move out of narcissism. It's a move, we can get our minds off ourselves long enough to actually see the harm we've done to others and to be concerned about them and to want to do something to make it right. So these themes are central in so many different conditions that bring people to therapy, although they have no idea when they walk in that this is what's going on very often underneath. I'm not trying to reduce all mental problems to this, but I would have to say that this is pretty central to a lot of what brings people to therapy.
Mm-hmm. So if a person is experiencing negative effects from some kind of guilty response to something that's happened in their lives, what are some behaviors or symptoms that they might notice that might lead them to sort of realize this is what the problem is?
Well, they might not realize that this is what the problem is. They may realize this is a problem. Okay, they're suffering. Suffering people come to therapy. Very often they try everything else first. They may try to convince themselves that their problem is entirely physical. They may see every other kind of doctor. Eventually they may get the idea that, wait a minute, there's something psychological going on here. And so they come to therapy. Depression. Very often people have no... they're aware that they're down. Or they may be aware that their moods are cycling and they're going way too up and then they're going way too down. And, if they see certain kinds of experts, they will tell them this is a brain problem and they'll put them on antidepressants or something. I'm not big into those kinds of psychoactive medications. I think they often... Well, the philosopher Kierkegaard argued that these kinds of symptoms, anxiety, sadness, depression, these are messages from the soul, as far as Kierkegaard is concerned, and they are indicators that there's something wrong in your life. There's something wrong in the way you're living. That's why you're having depression. That's why you're having anxiety. And therefore, these are messages that need to be investigated and heard and decoded in order that you can begin to discover what it is in your life that's wrong, that is generating these panic attacks or these depressive attacks or whatever else the overt symptomatology happens to be. So that's what we try to figure out mm-hmm. in the therapeutic process.
Right. Now, talking about the play Skylight, I'll just give a little bit of grounding for any listeners who are unfamiliar with the play.
Right.
But it tells the story of a couple, Kira and Tom, who had a 6-year-long affair while Tom was married.
Right.
And Kira was a really close friend of the family. She was best friends with Tom's wife, Alice, close with his right. children. And as soon as Alice discovered the affair after 6 years, Kira left on a dime, didn't say right. goodbye, just vanished.
Right.
Shortly after that, Alice was diagnosed with cancer and died. And now, a year after her death, first, Tom's son, Edward, has come to Kira's apartment to try to reconcile with her, to push her to reconcile with his father, and then Tom himself arrives. Now, Kira has moved on by creating an entirely new life for herself. She was an upper-middle-class restaurant manager with a wealthy, you know, with all the trappings of wealth when she was associating with Tom's family. Now she's moved to this dismal area, working with children with severe behavioral problems who, you know, engage in acts of disrespect and even violence against their teachers. It's a difficult job. She doesn't particularly like it, although she does think it's important. And Tom has moved on from his feelings by throwing himself into his work and spending money lavishly and having emotional outbursts at his son. So they're both dealing with the guilt and shame of this affair and this betrayal of Alice in different ways. So I wanted to talk to you about your impressions of these actions when you read the play. How did you feel about David Hare, the playwright's characterizations of guilt and shame through these characters?
I thought the play was really interesting. And my understanding and my reactions to the play deepened every time I read it. I think I've read it about 4 or 5 times now. And it probably really was only about the third time going through that I began to feel I was really getting a grip on this play and having a deepened appreciation of what Hare has achieved here. Where to start? The first reading of the play, you're very aware of what a bombastic, narcissistic character Tom is, okay? And he's also a symbol of neoliberal capitalism. Thatcher, there's a whole critique of Thatcher's neoliberal, market fundamentalism nonsense in the play, and he embodies that beautifully. I mean, he's out for number one. He's aggressive. He's a bit of a caricature of the narcissistic male, so full of himself, but at the same time likable, intelligent, charming, energetic. He gets things done, but he's a total snob. I mean, he looks down on the lower orders of society. So he's easy to identify as a narcissist and a coward. You know, the wife he's been unfaithful to has now got cancer and dying. And so, you know, his act of reparation is to throw money, which is nothing to him. He throws money to build, they move to Wimbledon. And he builds her a house, and he's got, and it's called Skylight because over her bed is the skylight, and she's able to lie in bed and watch the birds. And he put a lot of money into this, he tells us, and that's his act. But he can't be with her,
and he can't speak to her. He abandons her. He travels.
He
while
travels
she dies.
To Europe. He's not even there. And the son observes this, and this is one of the big things that Tom has against his son, because the son has watched the whole thing, and he's observed the father's cowardice. He's observed the father's desertion of the dying mother while she's dying. And so he holds up a mirror in which, if Tom looks at himself in his son's eyes, he's hit with guilt that he doesn't want to encounter. So he's hostile to the son. The son, in his view, is a total shit, which certainly doesn't come across. He comes across as a nice young kid in the play, mm-hmm. but the father sees him as, the father really devalues him. So that whole story, and of course he's a symbol of the kind of me, narcissistic, grasping business, money is everything. He's a perfect symbol of that kind of neoliberal capitalist, every man for himself ethic. So that's well done. Kira, on the other hand, I mean, my initial tendency was to see her more as a bit of a victim of this narcissistic male, but then I started reading it, and I'm thinking, come on, she's equally, well, maybe not equally, but she's pretty guilty in her own way. I mean, if Tom has self-serving illusions, so does she, big time. I mean, she feels fine about sleeping with her friend Alice's husband as long as Alice doesn't know. And of course, from a Freudian point of view, the situation echoes the famous Freudian Oedipus complex, because she's like 18. When she comes, is adopted more or less by this couple, who are almost old enough to be her parents. And so Alice is his mother, Tom is father, and she's sleeping with daddy behind mommy's back. And she doesn't feel any guilt about this for 7 years until mommy finds out. Then she's gone, okay? Now, obviously, unconsciously, she does experience guilt because she is engaging in, well, earlier on, I distinguished the two kinds of guilt, mm-hmm. the punitive guilt and the reparative guilt. She is indirectly making reparation for her sins, mm-hmm. okay? She's working in this poor area with poor kids. She's a devoted teacher. That is an act of reparation. In that sense, she's not nearly as narcissistic as Tom mm-hmm. is. I mean, Tom can't make reparation. He doesn't get reparation because he's too much about me. She's far less narcissistic. She sees things. But for 7 years, she didn't see the guilt. She blinded herself to the guilt for cheating on you know, with Tom behind Alice's back.
And at the same time, after Alice discovers the affair, Kira has 2 more years in which she could have made reparations directly to Alice before
Absolutely.
Alice actually dies. And instead, Kira's off in a different city.
She just disappears.
She vanishes. So that's really interesting to me. And I mean, her first line when she sees Tom, her lover of 6 years after 3 years separation, the first thing she says to him, it's not hello, it's not come in, what are you doing here? She says, I'm not guilty.
Exactly. I noticed that, I think, on about the fourth reading of the play. I noticed that's the very first thing she says. She's making a joke about something else, but there it is. She's not even referring to their lives there when she says, I'm not guilty. She says, I forget what the context
is. She says, you've shown up like a stormtrooper at the door. You know, as in...
Oh, that's right. He has stormed like a stormtrooper, and she's saying, like, he's arrived like the police or the Gestapo, and she's saying, I'm not guilty. She's making a joke. But as you say, it's the first thing that comes out of her mouth, which indicates how guilty she really is. You know, she's confessing right there and then, unconsciously, to the whole situation. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in going through sort of all the relationships in the play, because I feel like Hare's done a really interesting job of showing different ways in which different people deal with these feelings. So let's talk about Alice. So Alice is Tom's wife, and Kira's, as you said, her sort of adopted mother.
Right.
Kira and Alice are best friends, and Kira's been sleeping with Alice's husband for years. And when Alice finds out, rather than reacting with anger or, you know, indicting Tom for his behavior, she reacts with sweetness. She withdraws emotionally from him, but she says to him, don't worry about me. I'm happy just reading and gardening. I don't blame you for loving Kira. She's more beautiful than me. She's smarter than me. I was never smart enough for you. You had such good taste to choose her.
Uh-huh.
So Tom feels like he can never have a real conversation with her because she's using her kindness, her understanding as a weapon against him, and it increases his guilt. Can you talk a little bit about that tactic and the effect it has on Tom?
That's the martyr's tactic. I mean, Christian martyrs twisted the knife for thousands of years. The stereotypical martyr is incredibly guilt-inducing. So she's a martyr. And there's a streak of masochism in this, right? And there's also a streak of holier than thou. So this is the martyr's technique. Alice is one big martyr. And I suppose in the face of that, Tom's running away becomes a little more understandable.
Is it? I mean, I feel like you could have a conversation. I don't get the impression from reading the play several times that they ever had a truthful conversation about what actually happened.
Yeah, but if she's all the time saying, it's okay, you made a wise choice, blah, 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 it's fine, I mean, can you have a real conversation with someone who's talking like that?
I don't know, is there some way to cut through that? You tell me. I feel like I could cut through that.
Well, I think it would be worth a try, and I would certainly try, but I don't think... I mean, Tom is just so narcissistic and so not wanting to go to anything like guilt. I don't think he's going to be the kind of person who could make the effort to cut through that.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else probably could or maybe could, although I don't think it's easy. You don't become a martyr and a masochist like that overnight.
Hmm.
I mean, look, I mean, for 7 years, this woman has managed to turn a blind eye to what must have been obvious. Now, this is not rare. I mean, in my practice over the years, the numbers of wives that I have encountered and known about who are absolute masters at not seeing what is right in front of their eyes because they don't want to see. And you know, it's pretty hard to have a conversation with a person who is that skilled in denial.
Hmm. That's interesting. Okay, well, let's move on a little bit. Let's talk about Tom and Edward. So I liked what you said about how Edward is essentially holding a mirror up to Tom. And through Edward's eyes, Tom is able to really see the depth of his own missteps. He does enough to be horrible to his son and kick him out of the house. So can you talk a little bit about that? Once somebody has seen you, I remember reading somewhere, once somebody has seen you at your lowest... There's a certain kind of person who will never be able to accept that person again. Once they know that they've revealed their deep vulnerability or been humiliated in front of somebody,
right?
They can never accept that person into their life again, and they'll turn against them. Can you talk about that in light of the father-son relationship?
The philosopher Nietzsche got at that in one of his famous aphorisms. What does he say? Something like, the one thing that a person can never forgive you for is for having helped them out in a time of need.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've seen you at your weakest. But I mean, I think this really applies again to highly narcissistic people. I mean, I think Tom is a pathological narcissist. And these are people who are grandiose and arrogant and self-obsessed. And the reason they are is because deeply buried, deep down, is intense shame, an intense sense of inferiority. I mean, arrogance is always the opposite of inferiority. You know, no one puts themselves up unless on some level they feel really low. Okay, but skilled narcissists have got such ironclad defenses against their feelings of inadequacy that they just never go there, or they rarely go there. And also, if they are talented, I mean, major politicians and so on are these types of people. CEOs of big companies, if they have the talent to make it work, they can be very, very successful because their talent enables their grandiosity to be constantly mirrored. They're skilled enough to get constant applause, and so they keep this grandiose show on the road, and they never get to the underlying, or seldom, in moments, nightmare moments, they'll get to it. Okay, they'll have a nightmare, or something will happen.
Their infidelity will be discovered.
Yeah, exactly. But they usually get the defenses back very quickly.
Right.
Except as they age. Aging narcissists, it's a nightmare because that's what age is, loss. I mean, my dear friend who died a few years ago, my mentor, Eli Sagan, sociologist, colleague of mine, he said, he's about 15 years older than me, he said, "Don, you want to know the secret of aging? Tell me, Eli." He says, "It's loss. It's loss, and it's more loss." Okay? Narcissists can't stand losing. They're all about building themselves up. But when you start losing your powers, you start losing your potency, you start losing your vision, you start getting aches and pains, and you're not the stud anymore. You know, so then the underlying inferiority feelings that have been warded off so successfully, they start coming up. So aging is a nightmare for But a guy like Tom, he's only 50. He's still a vital guy. He's got energy, and he's able to stay away from those feelings. So the fact that his son saw his weakness, saw his cowardice, is something that he can't stand. So he can't stand his son.
Mm-hmm. I feel like David Hare really captures something about what you said, the aging narcissist, in his portrayal of Tom, because Tom has everything. He's got this chain of restaurants that are successful. He's got a yacht. He's got a life. He's got a beautiful girlfriend. He's got a beautiful wife. He's got beautiful children. Everyone loves him. And in a moment, it all comes crashing down, and he loses his lover. And then his wife becomes ill, and he loses her love. He loses her respect. And then he loses her physically. And then he's losing the respect of his son. He's just thrown his son out of the house.
Right.
He's lost everything. And he comes to Kira, and he says, "I always thought I have to behave well while this is happening. While Alice is dying, I'll behave well, because if I can just hold it together, there's a chance I can get Kira back."
Right.
So now he's come a year later to try to get her, get something back.
Right, he's in trouble.
He's in trouble. He's lost his son. He's lost his wife.
Right.
And Kira, well, I won't give away the ending, but I think you really see a portrait of somebody really on the edge of
There's another factor. There's another factor. He's no longer his own boss. He went public.
Right.
The company went public, and now he's got a chairman of a board. And he just drips with contempt towards this guy he has to report to. It's very hard for a self-made entrepreneurial narcissist like that to suddenly have a boss looking over his shoulder. So that's another way that his life has taken a turn for the worse.
Mm-hmm. And I want, you know, with Tom, I want to talk a bit about this, because the reason the affair is discovered, I think, is significant. So Kira is a reserved person who sort of keeps her feelings close to her chest.
Yeah.
But there's a period of time in their relationship when they're separated for a while, and she writes him love letters.
Right.
And she tells him, "I poured my heart out to you in those letters. I gave you everything I had in those letters."
And she told him to burn them.
Burn the letters. Don't ever let Alice find the letters. And what does Tom do? He leaves the letters in the kitchen where Alice is almost guaranteed to find them, which is how the affair comes to light. Can you talk a little bit about... I feel like throughout history, we see this repeated pattern of people engaging in behavior that could jeopardize their entire life, like a politician having a sordid affair.
Yes.
And they're right on the edge of risk, and it's almost like they're asking to be discovered.
Oh, absolutely. And I think unconsciously they are asking to be discovered. I mean, it's a cliche. The husband who leaves the matches from the restaurant in his pocket. I mean, you know, there's a million ways. You know, certain police will tell you that they don't catch criminals. Criminals catch themselves.
They come back to the scene of the
crime.
They
return to the scene of the crime. They leave clues and so on. I think it is a measure of the guilt that he is repressing. He's not consciously feeling guilt, but he, on some level, he knows that this cheating on his wife under the wife's very nose is wrong behavior. He has what Freudians call a superego, which is not exactly a conscience, because it's more like a hanging judge. It's a stern, critical part of the self. And he is very good at binding it and gagging it and making it shut up. But in the dark of night, it doesn't entirely shut up. Every once in a while, it gets its pitchfork into you, okay? And so you feel guilty on that deeply unconscious level, and that translates into a need to get punished. Look, you see it in childhood. The kid goes, he knows he's not allowed to have cookies before dinner. He goes into the kitchen where the cookie jar is. No one's around. He helps himself, but now he's anxious. He might even confess. He might even confess and get scolded, and now, having gotten scolded, he can relax because he's gotten the punishment that he feels he deserves. Okay, so people are constantly getting themselves caught for this kind of reason, and I certainly think that that's what's happening with Tom. I mean, he clearly arranged to get caught because he needed to get punished, mm-hmm. and he did, big time.
Yeah. Let's talk about Kira and her her reparative tactics in the face of her guilt. So she moves into this lower income neighborhood and works in a school where the children are so vicious that they murdered the previous teacher's cat.
Baked it, left it in the oven.
They spat on her face the first day they met her. And she, when Edward says, "Do you like it?" She says, "Well, no, I don't exactly like it. I do feel stretched. And I think that if I didn't do this work, nobody else would." Right. So I'm a little struck by, I mean, I guess I'm somebody, I relate to this character on some levels. I'm somebody who works with young people as well. Sometimes they've had difficult, you know, life histories. And the way that Kira talks about her students and her neighborhood, to me, partly the play is 20 years old, so the way people discuss different topics have changed, but some of the ways that she frames her students' backgrounds, I think are insulting. You know, she mm-hmm. talks about social workers clean out the drains of society. We deal with all the garbage. We deal with, and she's using these phrases in with good intentions, but I wouldn't discuss anybody I've ever worked with as being something that I found in a drain or, right. or their problems as being garbage, right? Right. There's right. a dismissive and condescending attitude right. in some of the ways that she describes the work, which to me is partly a function of people's sensitivity towards language changing with time,
right.
but also there's a layer upon which I feel like she's treating her clients or her you know, associates with some contempt and still seeing herself as above them, even though she tries to walk among these people, right. which I think is really interesting because to me it speaks to what you've mentioned about reparative tactics, where she's trying to make up for something
right.
and her motives for doing so aren't entirely as selfless as she hopes they make her look. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. My son is a social worker, and so I know something about the profession. And modern social work as a profession has bent over backwards to distance itself from the social work of, say, the early 20th century, which was like Lady Bountiful. It was like a rich upper middle class or upper class lady with her white gloves going, kind of holding her nose and going into slums and giving to the poor, yeah. you know, and then feeling better about it.
And it's paternalistic and it's narcissistic. It's totally. Not about the people you're helping. It's about creating a dynamic in which they have to depend on you and thank you. And
you get to pat yourself on the back for all of your generosity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is definitely going on. I mean, it's very clear. Kira had an upper middle class upbringing. She was the daughter of a lawyer, an attorney.
She's highly educated.
And yeah, she's doing atonement, and yeah, she is looking down in significant ways. Her language is very significant in the way that she's looking down on these people, and basically kind of using them as part of her project of atoning.
In a way, she's proving to herself that she's not that bad.
Yes. Well, she's pretty guilty. She's got a problem. She's warding off this guilt. She's a very smart. She comes across extremely intelligent. On some level, it's not clear. Hare hasn't made it clear how conscious her guilt is. It remains a bit of a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know whether she's actually saying to herself, how could I have done this under Alice's nose for 7 years and had her as a dear friend? How horrible. How unconscionable. Is she saying that to herself? It's not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she's saying that to herself. Okay. The fact that she's not saying it to herself means that it's unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
She is feeling that. She has to feel that because she's so intelligent. She has to feel that, but she's keeping it unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So she's warding it off.
She's punishing herself with bad cheese in a cold apartment.
And now she's punishing herself for the guilt that she will not really acknowledge. And she's using these people around her to help her feel better, for sure. Yeah.
Now, as a therapist, what would you recommend for someone in a position like hers where the person she's wronged is now dead? She can't ever apologize.
Right.
What are healthy ways of dealing with those feelings?
Yeah. You have to find symbolic ways then. You can't actually make reparation. I had a PhD supervisor who was very good to me. And after I got my PhD, I got busy hustling my own career. And once I did a thing on TVO and he saw it and he phoned me and I said, when I get back to Toronto, we'll get together. And I got busy again. And then I called and I got his widow.
Ugh.
Okay. So a year or so later, I met another man, much older than me, who was very good to me. And so here's an opportunity to make reparation. I can't make reparation to that man, but I'm going to be very careful to be very good and available and with this other man. So that's what you have to do. I mean, you have to find someone else in need or some symbolic way to make reparation. Now, the question is about Kira, about what...
Well, if given that Kira is now sort of having her feelings about this long ago occurrence pulled into the light because Edward and Tom have arrived on her doorstep.
Right.
What are some things that a character like that or that she could do to assuage her guilt or to deal with it in a healthy way?
The first thing, I mean, I am a therapist. And so the first element...
Come to therapy.
Yeah. Well, become whether you do it in therapy or whether you do it with a priest or you do it with a friend or you do it with yourself, but you have to become conscious of your guilt. I mean, I don't think that you can make genuine reparation until you first have confessed fully to yourself. You know, she has to be able to look in the mirror and say, what I did to Alice was horrific. And she has to feel that guilt. And she has to become contrite. And then once, because you see, genuine reparation is not warding off guilt feeling. The guilt feeling is there and it's felt and it's acknowledged. And then the reparation is a way of getting past it. It's not a way of going around it. It's a way of going through it and then moving past it.
If it doesn't hurt, you're not doing it right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, there can be a lot of creative things that you can do in a reparative way, but only after you first faced and worked through the guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not doing that. She's kind of like repairing for a crime which she is not even fully acknowledging having committed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you think are the insights that people will take away from this play?
Well, like I said, I had to read it 3 or 4 times to really get it. I think a lot of people who just see it for the first time are going to be quite moved. They're going to be shaken. Well, first of all, the dialogue is just incredibly amusing. I mean, both Tom, some of his diatribes are just hilarious. He does this one diatribe about spirituality.
Yes.
He can't stand people who say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm a very spiritual person. I completely agree with everything he says there about spirituality, frankly. But no, I mean, the dialogue is so intelligent. Kira is got such a dry, well, he acerbic wit. This is a play that, you know, should really be enjoyed. But it's going to shake people as well. But I think a lot of people are going to go out scratching their heads unless they go and then read the play or come and see it again and really think about it deeply. I think some of this stuff isn't going to fully register. I mean, it didn't register for me right away. I mean, what are people going to take away from it? I don't know whether people are going to get the guilt angle so much on this. I think people initially are certainly going to see Tom as the symbol that he is of the narcissistic male.
I think it's amazing that after she becomes ill, he repeats his courtship of her when she was a beautiful model and he was falling in love. He bought her roses every day. And when she's dying after his betrayal, he buys her roses every day and she tells him, I don't want these because they only meant something when you were in love with me. Yeah, they don't mean anything now. I can't, to me, it's almost, the gesture is cruel in its irony.
Yes.
It's amazing to me that somebody could ever choose that as their...
But you know, I mean, I'm not so amazed by it. I mean, the dumbness of this man bringing roses, having cheated on his wife this way under her nose for 7 years, now she's ill, he's bringing her roses. A lot of dumb guys would do something like that. Yes. I don't find that so. I mean, you know, look, I mean, you know, somewhere the guy learned the way to a woman's heart is to give her roses. So she's dying. He's giving her roses. I mean, you know, he learned that formula.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, the roses weren't roses. The roses were a symbol of love. And right. At any point in her life, she would certainly rather have a half-used bar of soap given with love
yes.
than a truckload of roses given sure. out of sure. some misguided sense of obligation.
Yeah.
Can you talk about ways in which guilt or shame can be positive?
Well, again, the two kinds of guilt. I don't see really anything very positive about persecutory guilt. All you do is beat yourself up. And the people who are busy beating themselves up, every once in a while, in order to stop beating themselves up, they beat somebody else up. That's the scapegoat mechanism, right? I mean, when I'm depressed, my superego has me in its crosshairs. Okay, but if I can shift it and put someone else into its crosshairs, that guy over there is the sinner. Okay, let's attack him instead of attacking me. People can get relief from depression by targeting somebody else. All of this is destructive. That's just destructive guilt. What's useful is reparative guilt. I mean, and I distinguish between conscience and the superego. The superego is the inner moralistic, reproachful, hanging judge torturer. Conscience is quite separate. The superego is about aggression turned on the self and sometimes on scapegoats. Conscience is grounded in love. It's grounded in concern. It's grounded in the early loving mother-infant relationship where mother is loving the baby and the baby is loving mother back and you've received love and so you know you should give love. You were cared for. You know you have an obligation to give care back. That's conscience. And when you are out of sync with your conscience, when you're doing something wrong, your conscience bothers you. The superego tortures you. The conscience, see, the superego's attitude is, okay, I've caught you in wrongdoing, good. Now I can do what I like to do, which is beat the shit out of you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Conscience doesn't react that way. The conscience is saddened by the fact that you're doing wrong. It's sad that you're doing wrong, and it encourages you to turn around and do right because it wants... It has your well-being in mind, and it wants you, it knows you're better than that. It wants you to cut out that nonsense and get back on the right path in life. And it invites you, it calls you to do that. So it calls you to contrition, and it calls you to apology and to reparative action. And that is useful guilt. See, I mean, Freud really got this backwards because he didn't distinguish these two kinds of guilt. And he thought that in order to have a civilized society, we have to repress our dark side, our dark sexuality, our dark aggressive selfishness. This is the price we pay, he thought, to live in a civilized society. But the price of pushing all of that down is increasing levels of guilt. So he thought that civilized society led to this buildup of guilt. But the only guilt that he was looking at was this punitive guilt. And so he felt that what we need in society is less guilt, less punitive guilt. He's right about that. But what he didn't understand is that in civilized society, we need much more guilt of the reparative kind.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the problem in society is we're not guilty enough. We've got too much of this beating ourselves up and scapegoats. And we don't have enough of this taking responsibility, acknowledging our faults, and getting busy to overcome our faults and make reparation for them. I mean, that we need a lot more of. So that is really useful. I mean, that is how I measure progress in therapy. People come in and they're torturing themselves in one way or another, and they don't even know why they're torturing themselves. Okay, in the course of the therapy, they discover why they're torturing themselves, and they stop torturing themselves.
And instead of torturing themselves, they are now feeling consciously guilty. And they're feeling bad about the harm they've done to other people and to themselves. And they start doing things to make reparation for the harm. And now they're starting to feel better about themselves. And their self-esteem is rising. In other words, they are beginning to win their own self-respect. That's the only way out of psychological problems, is to earn your own self-respect and start acting in changed ways. That's the course of a good therapy.
Right. That's interesting. And I will say, you know, even though I do cringe at some of the language that Kira uses to describe the people that she works with, I'll take her brand of slightly paternalistic reparation you know, straight self-interested capitalism.
Oh, well, totally. I mean, she's doing good work. She's doing good work. She's doing useful things. Her attitudes are still too much Lady Bountiful, you know, for sure. But nevertheless, she is doing good things. I mean, what's Tom doing? He's just doing what he always did, making money, bossing people around. Yeah.
I wanted to grab a couple of little sort of sound bites about the play. So something to the effect of, as a psychotherapist, I feel that Skylight...
Okay. So as a psychotherapist, I feel that Skylight, among other things, gives a wonderful depiction of the male narcissistic personality and his, you know, inability to feel any kind of positive guilt, his flight from guilt and shame, and his grandiosity, and his self-centeredness, his self-interestedness, and his contempt for people who, you know, he devalues. So I think it's a wonderful depiction of that, and I think it shows how, you know, the kind of neoliberal society that emerged with Thatcher and Reagan has produced this kind of character, and enabled this kind of character to, made it easier for him to justify his narcissism. It celebrates selfishness. I mean, what, Ayn Rand is a celebration of selfishness. And that is the ideology that was actually taken up by neoliberal capitalism. And he just embodies this. So I think that's beautifully portrayed, and its connections with the wider society are beautifully portrayed. I think in Kira, it also shows a kind of self-deceptive, far less so than Tom, but nevertheless, she's engaged in self-deception. She hasn't really acknowledged fully her guilt, although she's busy making a far more creative kind of reparation. She is making reparation. I don't see Tom as making any reparation. She is making reparation. It is useful. But nevertheless, you know, she still hasn't really faced herself fully. And I think the play shows that. What else does the play achieve? What about Edward? I mean... Okay, here's something that the play depicts. It shows the damage done to the children by narcissistic parents. In this case, particularly by the narcissistic father. But, you know, the mother was busy being her martyr. And she's engaged in denial and self-deception and so on as well. So, I mean, this kid has got not great parents, and he's hurt. He's confused. He's wounded. He's crying for help. You know? The father is now falling apart. The play gives us a depiction of the breakdown of a grandiose narcissist. What's going to happen now? He's not getting Kira back. Is he drinking heavily? Does it say? I mean, this would be in reality. This guy would be tossing back the booze. Well, he was throughout the play. He's drinking whiskey throughout the play. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think there's a good chance he's going to sink into alcoholism now. And then probably the heart will go. And he probably won't make it to age 60. That's my fantasy about what happens now, you know? Unless he's so narcissistic he's able to just... put it all behind himself and go find a Kira substitute, someone, you know, 30 years younger than him who will be impressed, who would be happy to soothe Tom's, bruised ego. He wouldn't have any trouble. And maybe he'll do that. I mean, it's either that or he'll drink himself to death. I don't know what. But he's having a major breakdown. And he's going to turn around and find out that not only is the wife he cheated on dead, the mistress is gone, but the son's gone. There's a daughter.
She's off at university.
God, we don't know what her... But I imagine she wanted to get out of that house. So who knows? She's probably gone too.
Hmm.
This is a guy who drives people away because he's all about me, right? You mm-hmm. know.
And so yet you described him as charming.
Well, sure. I mean, there is. Well, the son says his charm is that deep. He says, holding thumb and forefinger together. He says his charm is that deep, and I think that's true. I think it is. You know, like in my field, in psychoanalysis, we have Otto Kernberg, who is the world's sort of expert on narcissistic personality disorders, and that is one of the descriptions of the pathological narcissist. Shallow charm. Beneath the charm, says his son, Edward, he's a bastard. So... I guess those are the things that I would take away from the play. These are very interesting characters. The masochistic, martyrish wife, the self-deceptive mistress who's engaged, who knows she's sinned and she's trying to make reparation. It's not even clear in her mind that she's... Well, he sees it. He accuses her of exactly that. And he's right in his assessment. I mean, again, that's part of what you sort of have to admire in a guy like Tom. Sure, he's this bombastic narcissist, but he's really intelligent. And he speaks some truths.
He speaks truth to her, and she speaks truth back to him. It's interesting because they can each see each other. They can see through each other in a heartbeat.
Yes, yes,
which
yes.
speaks to their chemistry.
Right.
But they're both completely self-deceived about yes. their own behavior, which I think
Precisely.
Is really funny. And
that
I mean,
is,
who hasn't thing. Been in a relationship like that?
Yeah, of course, of course. I mean, you know, that's why in psychoanalysis, the only way we as analysts get to be able to analyze someone else is to clock years on the couch ourselves, okay? Because, and then, you know, the patients have feelings towards us, but we develop feelings towards the patient. We call that the countertransference. We're always going back into supervision, where Freud advised us to go back into analysis every 5 years. Some of us do that.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. You can't see the back of your own head. You know, the unconscious, you could spend your whole life in analysis, and it never bottoms out. You don't get to the bottom of it because we can't see ourselves entirely, and we need someone else to mirror ourselves back to us and to tell us what we can't see, you know?
On that topic, I'm curious about your partner also being an analyst. Can you talk about your relationship a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's when we met and she took me into her home and showed me her library, the two of us almost fell over because I would say 95% of the books that were in her library are in my library. We'd read the same damn books. So we see very much eye to eye, although she's trained in a slightly different school of thought. So we have differences and they spark a lot of interesting. We dialogue with one another. We don't see eye to eye 100%. On the other hand, you know, analysis for us is work. We like to get paid. And so we don't want to do it all the time. You know, we're not constantly analyzing one another, and we're not constantly analyzing other people because it's work, you know. Mm. You do it as a profession. You don't do it all the time. Although we do pull out the analytic concepts when we go to a film that's interesting, and we head off and have a drink and take the film apart from a psychoanalytic point of view. Of course we do that. I think overall it's very helpful because we believe in, we practice the talking cure. We believe in talk. And so when things go wrong between us, as they often do, as they do in any relationship, we talk it out. We may not do it immediately. It may take a few days of avoidance to get around to it, but eventually we sit down and we put it all into words and we lay it out as best we can and try to resolve it through talk. Yeah.
That's great. That's interesting. I like to imagine what dinner looks like. And one more little soundbite for me. Okay. Skylight's portrayal of the toxic effects of guilt and shame.
Skylight, I think, does reveal the toxic effects of guilt and shame that are repressed and unconscious. It's not the guilt and shame themselves that have a toxic effect. It's the repression of them, you know, the avoidance of them. So, you know, Tom just can't acknowledge his guilt. Well, neither can Kira. The toxic effects are clearest in the effect on his son, Edward, of the father's unacknowledged guilt. The son saw it. And so Tom hates his son because the son is aware. Kira, I don't think is leading a very happy life. She's freezing in this apartment that she's not even heating properly. I mean, it's a little bit like she sent herself to jail.
Mm-hmm. She's in the gulag, absolutely.
Yeah, she's in the gulag. Siberia. He says Siberia. Sent herself to Siberia, okay? Like, now, she would not have to continue to put herself into this bread and water prison Siberia if she fully came consciously to terms with her guilt. It's because she won't fully acknowledge her guilt and bring it out and face it and talk about it. If she did that, she could get over it. Then she wouldn't have to live in the cold with one little band on the heater. So she's paying a big price, again, for her failure to acknowledge her guilt.
That's great. Is there anything else you want to say?
I was puzzled by the use of the quotation from the Yeats poem at the beginning. Where is it here? We had fed the heart on fantasies. The heart's grown brutal from the fare. So I think here, fantasies, illusions. You know, everybody in this play, except even Edward wasn't aware that Kira and his father were having an affair. But certainly Kira and Tom had the illusion that they could help themselves to this pleasure and that it wouldn't hurt anyone as long as they kept it secret. Well, that is a total illusion because ultimately there are no secrets. I mean, now even in physics, we have the idea. I mean, it used to be mystics who said everything connects. But now scientists say everything connects. A butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon. It affects the weather in Toronto. People have this illusion that there's no hiding place, that there is a hiding place. They have the illusion that the left hand doesn't need to know what the right hand is doing. But it all comes out, and it affects it even while it's happening. It affects. He and Tom and Kira get together and have sex in the afternoon, and then he comes home and he's having dinner with Alice, and he's not different. She's not picking up vibrations. He's just been with this other woman. You know, I mean, she has to know, and whether she doesn't want to know, that's her illusion. She's maintaining the illusion that nothing is happening here. He's maintaining the illusion that what he's doing isn't hurting her. Mm-hmm. Kira is maintaining the illusion that what she's doing isn't hurting her. So
the heart has grown brutal.
The heart has grown brutal as a result.
Yeah.
So I think it's a perfect, epigram for the play, really. People's illusions and the harm that's done and how hard they work to preserve their illusions. I mean, illusions are hard to see through, you know? Again, that's why we need other people who see us better than we can see ourselves.
You should know.
Yeah, well, but it works both ways. You know, I mean, patients, that's one of the great things about doing this kind of work is the patients see me.
Mm. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, sure. Patients, when you work with them intensively for a long period of time, they get to know you. They know your blind spots. They know your weak spots. And they will tell you about it. And one great psychoanalyst, Harold Searles, wrote a paper called The Patient as Therapist to the Analyst.
Mm.
And he said that's not so unusual, because he says all babies want to be therapists for their mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the fact that the baby wants to cure the mother is misunderstood. The Freudians think that the baby wants to cure the mother to get mother to straighten up and fly right and give him, the baby, the mothering he needs. That's an instrumental explanation. Searle says that's not what I'm talking about. The Kleinians say the baby wants to cure mother because he imagines that mother is suffering because he's hurt her.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants to repair mother, the damage he did to her. Searle says that's not what he's talking about either. He doesn't deny both of these exist. He says that's not what he's talking about. He says the baby wants to cure the mother out of sheer dumb love. The baby loves the mother. Doesn't want mommy to be sad. Doesn't want mommy to be anxious or depressed, so he wants to cure her just because he loves her, not because he wants to get something out of it or undo damage he's done. He just loves her, okay? So a lot of therapists get into therapy because they had mothers that they wanted to cure, and so they get into the trying to cure business, okay? But patients also want to cure their analysts. The patients come to be aware of the analyst's weak spots, biases, blind spots, and if it's a very strong patient, they'll tell you, right? I mean, you know, I work with a number of very strong women who have no problem letting me know when I'm full of shit.
Can you tell me some of the things they've called out on?
One said to me, Dawn, when they called it a talking cure, they mean the patient talks. I'll launch into some story that I think is helpful to something they've been talking about in their lives. I'll launch into some story and they'll say, Don, this is my time. I'm paying you a lot per minute here. Can we get back to me? Sometimes they will let me know that, the point of view that I'm pushing just doesn't work for them. That's not it, Dawn. I mean, you're barking up the wrong tree. I mean, can you just drop that theory? I'm telling you, it doesn't fit my life. Maybe it fits your other patient, but it doesn't fit me. Can we investigate more thoroughly me? I know you like that theory, but it isn't working for me.
How does that feel?
Well, part of me is, but I like it because they're teaching me something. I mean, it's an opportunity to learn. So my theory isn't working. So, okay, here's an opportunity to learn a new theory. I mean, so I drop it. Of course I drop it. I'm not trying to indoctrinate them. I'm trying to do a mutual... but I expect to be corrected, because sometimes I'm clumsy, and sometimes I'm arrogant, and sometimes I'm wrong, and sometimes I'm sleepy, and sometimes I had a bad night, and... human beings are imperfect instruments, and so the patient is going to tell me the ways in which I'm imperfect. But I'm also getting real gratitude sometimes when I'm doing something that's really been helpful.
Mm-hmm.
People will express gratitude and will thank me, sometimes with tears in their eyes, and this makes me feel very good. But you don't get the good without the other side of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very deep kind of connectedness with other people. And it's very gratifying work in that way. But it's hard at times.
Why did you become a therapist?
Originally, I went into analysis not because I had no intention of training. And I was guilty and self-punishing.
How did you self-punish?
By being anxious, by being unhappy, by sometimes getting depressed, by not letting myself be as successful as I otherwise could, by not being able to write my doctoral dissertation, you know, writer's block, that kind of symptom. So I sought analysis because I knew that there was something wrong with me. And so I sought analysis. I had done all of the trendy therapies, Gestalt, Primal Scream, blah, blah. All, it was the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. I did all that. And it was useless. And so my very first psychiatrist said, when I fired him, he said, consider psychoanalysis. And I said, what, they still do that thing with the couch? Didn't that go out with the horse and buggy? And he said, yeah, there's a man down the hall, and he's really good. So after doing all of these other crummy therapies, I thought, well, what the hell, I'll give it a try. So I called up the man down the hall, and I started seeing him 3 and 4 times a week and lying on his couch. And within a matter of weeks, I knew this was the therapy for me. This was what was going to work for me. And it did work. I started to change. I overcame the writer's block. I wrote the PhD. I got the PhD. I got a tenure-track position. I started publishing. And I thought, I'd like to do this. So as soon as I got tenure at the university, I applied to train as an analyst, and I've been practicing ever since. So, but it started out with a need to deal with my own personal craziness, and only then did it turn into a career ambition.
Huh.
Yeah.
And how are your relationships with your family and your, when you think back about your childhood and your past, how has that changed?
Well, my relationships, I'm pretty happy with them now. I'm in a very happy marriage. And my son is a joy.
That's great. Well, I've enjoyed this conversation so much, Don. Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for doing it.
Thanks. And to anyone listening, you can check out David Hare's Skylight, produced by Hidden Cove Theatre at Cannes Stage's Berkeley Theatre in Toronto. And it's running from June 10th through July 9th. And all of the information is on the Canadian Stage website.